Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University. This is Episode CXV, Ausonian Beast. After unleashing his unique brand of rule on the people of Rome, Caracalla becomes the problem of the provinces. After 212, he'll spend the rest of his reign either at war or on tour, making the Beast of Italy a problem for all Romans to deal with. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
Caracalla spends most of 212 in Rome itself, causing havoc, but in late 212, early 213, he leaves for the northern provinces in order to fight against the Alemanni, who are a Germanic tribe who are threatening the frontiers of a province called Raetia. This is the area of modern-day Bavaria, southern Germany. So this is a new tribe who Rome hasn't fought before. So Caracalla is going to go to the front in person and deal with this threat.
So what's his incentive to go in person then? I suppose it would be good to get away from Rome and get a bit of space between yourself and the havoc that you've caused. But also I get the impression from Caracalla that he's got a real desire, a real enthusiasm for being involved in warfare.
Yes, he wants to be seen as a military leader in his own right, not someone who's just following his father around, campaigning with him. He wants to be appreciated as a fellow soldier, but also as a military leader. So it's really important that he go to the front in person.
But he legitimately had a contribution to make almost. He was very physical and outgoing with the way that he lived and led his soldiers.
Definitely. So, I mean, this is someone who was trained in horse riding. He liked to swim in rough water, Cassius Dio tells us. So this was, you know, a man of immense physical power. And he liked to spend time with his troops living under canvas like a fellow soldier. And it's probably on this campaign that he made the Caracallus or the Caracalla cloak fashionable. So this was something that he really embraced, and the soldiers appreciated him for it as well. Caracalla goes to the front with some key allies, Iulius Avitus Alexianus, his uncle, who's married to Julia Domna's sister, Julia Maesa. I mentioned these Severan relatives because they're going to become really important later on.
I was about to say, I recognise that name, yeah. So
yes.
Let's bookmark that.
Yeah, we'll bookmark the family. And then also a senator who has the wonderful name of Gaius Octavius Appius Sutrius Sabinus. And the reason I mention him is he is one of Caracalla's key senatorial supporters. So once again, we can be seduced by Dio into thinking that Caracalla was opposed to all senators, but that's not true. So he has a senatorial coterie around him who benefit from his reign as well. Sutrius Sabinus is actually rewarded with the ordinary consulship in 214 afterwards. So he gets the year named after him as the first consul. And Julia Domna also goes as well, probably. There's circumstantial evidence for this, but I think it's strong circumstantial evidence. They can't have been on good terms, given what happened to Geta, but she accompanies Caracalla on all his campaigns.
I feel like that might be under duress, though.
It could very much be. I mean, she's really important to Caracalla's public image.
Yeah.
She is his mother, the wife of Divus Severus now, the deified Severus. In 211, she was even given the titles of Mater Senatus, so Mother of the Senate, and Mater Patriae, Mother of the Fatherland. So she's the first Roman Empress, Roman Augusta, to get the female equivalent of Pater Patriae, that she's now Mater Patriae as well.
Yeah.
So she is a major public figure. She's someone who's very much respected. She's like the Queen Mother, we might think so, in current terms. And it's really interesting the way she's presented. So Caracalla has the titles of Pius Felix, so that he is his pious, dutiful, and also fortunate. And this is something which Roman emperors have taken since Antoninus. But Julia Domna's coins style her Pia Felix, which are the feminine equivalents of Pius Felix. So she's being given the feminized titles of the Roman emperor. And again, she's the first imperial woman to have these titles. So Caracalla isn't married, but his mother is becoming the female counterpart in the public image of the regime.
Is this a fair point to bring up those rumors then?
Yes, I mean, certainly there were rumours that they were having an incestuous relationship. That's certainly not true.
There's actual quotes of, you know, if you would have me, take me.
This is in the Historia Augusta.
Oh, yes, is that? Yes, okay. Yes, oh, yeah. Sorry, yeah.
That's okay. Yes, no, in the Historia Augusta, certainly in late antiquity, they treat that as fact that Julia Domna turns up in front of him and says, yes, if you'll have me, take me. It plays on the idea of Nero and Agrippina as well.
Mm.
When Agrippina turned up in front of Nero, all dressed up to the nines, you know, salaciously trying to seduce him. The rumours made all the way to Alexandria. We'll talk later about his visit to Alexandria, but they're known there as well. And certainly in late antiquity becomes a big motif of the way they're portrayed.
Yeah.
They're almost certainly false, but this was how people tried to make sense of the emperor's relationship with his mother and how they were portrayed. So on cameos, Julia Domna was depicted as Victoria, the goddess of victory, crowning Caracalla. Images throughout the empire showed Caracalla, this young unmarried emperor, and his mother.
Mm.
And rumours are a sense-making phenomenon. They develop as a way of explaining situations which we can't explain otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the explanations is that they were having an incestuous relationship.
Correct me here if I'm wrong. We don't have a lot of detail of play-by-play of what happened in the Germanic War and who he's conquering because of how fragmentary Dio is at this point. But we do get a kind of insight into how he was received there and how he acted.
Very much so. It's very difficult to understand the course of the war against the Alemanni. Herodian talks about how he starts building alliances with the Germans in the region. He actually selects some of the Germans for his bodyguard, and they accompany him throughout his campaigns. He's supposed to be very much taking the lead, you know, carrying the standards of the legions on his shoulders. And this sort of action leading from the front won the support of his troops. And certainly by the end of 213, so September that year, we know that he was hailed Germanicus Maximus, or greatest conqueror of the Germans.
Mm.
And the Arval Brethren, a senatorial priesthood, even included Julia Domna in their official thanksgiving for Caracalla's success in Germany there as well. And so there are jokes about Caracalla's victory title of Germanicus Maximus, greatest conqueror of Germany, because he didn't achieve that. He pushed back the Alemanni from Roman territory, but he did not conquer their territory. So the Augustan history says that he gave himself the title Germanicus, either in jest or earnest, for he was stupid and crazy, and asserted that if he had conquered the Lucanians, he would have to be called Lucanicus.
Mm.
So the Lucanians are a tribe of people in Italy, and they've long been under Roman sway. So the idea of, you know, him conquering a part of Italy shows, you know, what a petty-minded individual he was and how he'd try and seek glory at all costs.
Yeah, taking a title that he hadn't really earned.
Yes, yeah, and there were lots of jokes about Caracalla's victory titles. We referenced the other one from Pertinax that he was Getticus Maximus, the greatest conqueror of Geta. So you find lampoons about his conquests, which sort of poke at the idea that he wants to be seen as a great military man.
Mm. And taking so many military titles like that as well was last seen, I suppose, in Domitian.
Yes, Domitian was famous for all his German victory titles.
Mm.
And certainly, you know, Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus had taken their fair share as well, but they actually had very successful campaigns. Now, this campaign wasn't a failure. We know that there were turf walls, forts built along the province of Raetia. So it does seem to have been a strengthening of the frontiers, but it wasn't a great conquest which added new territory to the empire. And there's certainly suggestions that he paid off the Germans to bring the war to a conclusion. We can't necessarily lay the blame for this solely at Caracalla. This was progressively becoming Roman policy to conclude wars with other tribes by giving them money.
Mm.
it was an easy way to forestall conflict at the present moment and leave any future problems to future emperors.
Yeah, yeah. So did we get any glimpses of his brutal nature while he's away at war as well?
We do in Cassius Dio, again, perhaps to be taken with a grain of salt. He's supposed to have terrorised the governors in the regions when he arrived. He's supposed to have sent other people away to provinces with wet and wild climates that would be uncongenial to their health. So far north of Britain or something like that, that they're not sunning themselves in Marseille. Dio says that because he was descended from Julia Domna, who was a Syrian, that it was part of his nature to be a cheater and a coward, and that he would summon people to court as a friend and then imprison them or kill them. Mm. Romans had this way of thinking about different peoples and ascribing them particular characteristics. So he associated that kind of duplicity with Syrians. Romans played on ethnic stereotypes, which are abhorrent to us today, of course, but yes. this is what they thought.
I was going to say racial profiling much, Dio?
Yeah, yes, exactly. It is racial profiling. There are also stories about what happened to Caracalla himself. He seems to have fallen ill during the campaign. Cassius Dio says he was frenzied and beside himself, which suggests some kind of madness. The Alemanni themselves claimed that they were responsible, that they had been casting spells to send Caracalla crazy. And Caracalla had dreams that his father and his brother Geta were pursuing him with swords. Mm. So he's feeling the guilt about what he had done there. He tried to make supplications to the gods, particularly Apollo, to try and restore his health, his mental stability, but they were not answered. So something seems to have gone very wrong towards the end of this campaign. This may also be where the impotence stories start as well. When Caracalla goes to Asia Minor later, there are stories of him going to healing sanctuaries of the gods as well to try and restore his health. But the idea that he's haunted by the murders he has committed plays a major role in Dio and the other historical accounts.
So how involved did Caracalla get in building his persona as a military leader?
He wanted to be seen very much as a second Alexander. And this is something that many Roman emperors had imagined themselves as being. Trajan, for example. You can go all the way back to Pompey as well. Mm. The people that imagined themselves conquering the East, conquering Parthia. Caracalla seems to have taken this to an extreme end. So he is decreed that statues and images of Alexander should be erected in Rome and all throughout the provinces. He's supposed to have his own phalanx, which was made up entirely of Macedonians, 16,000 men, which he called Alexander's phalanx. And he even promoted Macedonians. So, for example, he came across an equestrian tribune called Domitius Antigonus, whose father was called Philip, like Alexander's father.
Yeah.
And so he made him a senator. So, and these are the kind of things which rankled with someone like Cassius Dio and other conservative senators as well, because it's favouritism, but it's also part of this Alexander megalomania.
Mm.
So probably in late 213, the imperial court crosses to Asia Minor, but there's a shipwreck in which Caracalla is almost killed. To thank the gods for saving him, he goes to Troy. He sacrifices to the tomb of Achilles. And of course, Achilles was one of Alexander the Great's ancestors and heroes. And Alexander tried to emulate Achilles there as well. So this kind of act of imperial thanksgiving is linked to his Alexander mania as well. And later on in his life, he goes to Alexandria. And one of the reasons for going is to see the tomb of Alexander himself. Alexander is a difficult figure to emulate because in some ways he's remembered as the great general,
mm.
but he's also remembered as quite tyrannical figure,
drunk and moody, and both these ideas of Alexander feature in the Roman mindset. So while Caracalla may be trying to promote himself as, you know, the great general, other people can bring up his less favourable qualities as indications that he's a new Alexander reborn in the tyrannical mode.
Caracalla would be going, look at me, I'm just like Alexander. And everybody behind him would be going, yeah, he is just like Alexander. Yeah, he's a bit of an Alexander.
But not in the way he thought he was. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, so that can backfire on him as well.
Definitely.
So Caracalla spent quite an amount of time in Nicomedia, didn't he?
Yes, the imperial court probably spent the winter of 213-214 there, and probably several months after that as well. Now, it's really interesting. So Caracalla's there, Julia Domna's there, her Syrian relatives are there as well. But one other person who's there is Cassius Dio.
Yeah.
And he's there because he is a senator from Bithynia, which is a province which Nicomedia is in. And they're expected to host the emperor. They're supposed to call on him on a daily basis when he's there. They're expected to provide support, financial and in kind, for the troops that are with him. And so Cassius Dio is in quite close contact with Caracalla for several months.
So at this point we get first-hand impressions of day-to-day operations, I suppose.
Yes, yes. And they're not very good impressions either, given that it's Cassius Dio. He complains that Caracalla ignored him and the other senators, so they were expected to pay their respects to him on a daily basis, but Dio complains they were kept waiting until noon or even into the evening, and then sometimes they were sent away and say, come back tomorrow.
Mm.
And instead, Cassius Dio says he stays inside with his friends, freedmen and soldiers, carousing and drinking and eating.
So he's got no interest in the day-to-day operations of being an emperor?
No.
So how accurate is this sort of account, or is it just a little bit biased on Dio's account?
Well, it's clear that Caracalla definitely had his cronies, but Dio wasn't one of them. So I'm sure Dio was kept waiting there, but we can't say there were only, you know, freedmen and soldiers carousing with Caracalla inside. There were probably more favoured members of the court who didn't include Cassius Dio. Mm. But we know on other occasions, for example, Dio and Caracalla were at the same banquet, because Dio quotes what Caracalla says to him, you know, that he quotes Euripides to him. So over this long period, they did have interactions. It's just that Cassius Dio wasn't part of his close coterie there.
Yeah.
He does also report some gossip at court about Caracalla's sex life, that now he was impotent. So we're getting these two different stories, one that he was having an incestuous relationship with his mother, the other that he was impotent. And so Cassius Dio says because of this that he had to perform obscene acts in a different fashion. That is the translation.
That's really ambiguous.
It is ambiguous. It's ambiguous in the Greek as well. I think it's supposed to be. You're supposed to, you know, conjure up things in your imagination of all the obscene things Caracalla is doing with men of similar habits. You know, is he involved in homosexual liaisons somehow? We don't know. I think you're designed to let your imagination run riot there. It's clear what he wants to do in his history is to undermine Caracalla's image as a self-controlled emperor. Caracalla says that I am sophron, that's the Greek word for control over your passions and your desires. But by telling all these stories about his sex life, Dio is saying, well, no, let's look at this as well. So we get an insight here into the gossip which is circulating at the imperial court as a way of undermining Caracalla's regime.
Yeah, okay. So after they winter in Nicomedia, the royal party moves on, and we should probably make it clear at this point that he never actually goes back to Rome. He's travelling around the provinces that way.
Yes, once he leaves in late 212 or early 213, he never goes back to Rome.
Rome was probably a little bit happy about that.
Yes, I mean, he has his cronies who he leaves back in Rome in charge, and they're reporting things to him. But Caracalla, Julia Domna, the other Syrian relatives, part of the court, Praetorian prefects, they're all with him, and he never goes back to Rome.
Mm.
And part of the reason for this is that he is planning a war with Parthia. This is why he's in the east.
Yeah. So that's the long game. So after he leaves Nicomedia, where's his next stop? Or where's he heading towards now?
Well, he basically travels through Asia Minor, so modern-day Turkey, down to Antioch in Syria, which is a major city which is going to be his base for the Parthian campaign. So he spends quite a bit of time visiting the cities of Asia Minor, celebrating festivals in his honour, that kind of thing. And then they set up camp at Antioch. But he also has a desire to visit Alexandria in Egypt. So they go on an expedition there.
So the big draw card of Alexandria would be that this is a city named after Alexander and that the tomb of Alexander was there at the time.
Yes.
So this is a pilgrimage for him.
Very much so, to see the tomb of his hero and to see the temple of Serapis, who is one of Caracalla's favourite gods. Serapis is a sort of blending of Osiris and Apis, the Egyptian gods. But also we hear of other underhand reasons as to why he might be there. The fact that the Alexandrians were making jokes about him, and this has both been reported to him before he left Rome as well. So he may have been thinking about this for some time.
Yeah, so letting stew on it. What sort of jokes?
Well, they were joking about the fact that he had murdered Geta. They would have known all about this because of the massive Damnatio Memoriae, which was taking place. And they were all scratching Geta's name out of the papyri in the records. So they joked about his murder of Geta not only when he wasn't there, but also when he arrived in Alexandria. And the Alexandrians were known for their frankness of speech. They called Julia Domna Jocasta, who together with Oedipus, her son, who she married and had children with, bore in Greek mythology Eteocles and Polynices, two brothers who engaged in civil war over Thebes and killed each other.
Yeah, they're directly referencing that, but doing it through mythology.
Exactly.
So, not even thinly veiled.
No. Everyone would know when you're calling out that Julia Domna is Jocasta, that one, she had sex with her son, and secondly, that her two sons from that marriage
went to war,
were at each other's throats. This was a major insult to the imperial family. But they were also joking about the fact that he was trying to imitate Alexander and Achilles. They pointed out that Caracalla wanted to be like these men, but he was much smaller than them.
Yes.
And Alexander himself wasn't very tall either. So you sort of wonder how tall Caracalla was. In fact, there's lots of references to him being quite short. So a good emperor was supposed to put up with these kind of jokes. You're supposed to take it on the chin, you know, and carry on, maybe even answer back with something witty yourself.
Yeah.
But Caracalla wasn't that sort of guy. He thought these jokes...
They didn't read the room very well. Yeah.
No.
He took a very kind of public vengeance on the people of Alexandria.
Yes. There are lots of different accounts of this. According to Herodian, he orders the young men of Alexandria to gather for inspection, as if they were a phalanx drawn up in honour of Alexander the Great. And Herodian says in 4.9.6, Caracalla now approached them as they were drawn up in groups and passed among them, touching each youth and saying a word of praise to this one and that one, until his entire army had surrounded them. The youth did not notice or suspect anything. And then his troops were ordered to kill all the young men. Cassius Dio also talks about the massacre. Antoninus lived in the temple of Serapis throughout the massacre. He went there to dedicate the sword with which he had slain Geta to Serapis and then taken vengeance on the Alexandrians because of their actions. Dio even says, and this is 78.22, he slaughtered so many persons that he did not even venture to say anything about their number, but wrote to the Senate that it was of no interest how many of them or who had died, since all had deserved to suffer this fate. So it's a rather extreme reaction by an emperor to what are jibes which someone like Vespasian would have endured with equanimity.
This is the scale of a massacre, though, that an army would do to an enemy city.
Yes.
If they went in there, killed lots of people, enslaved anyone who survives, salt the earth, burn it to the ground. But these are on Roman citizens. This is your own people.
That's against inhabitants of the Roman Empire, definitely.
Yeah.
It was an outrageous act which definitely lived in memory, not only in Egypt, but throughout the entire empire. But it's interesting, Caracalla sort of liked people fearing him. An oracle at Pergamum in Asia Minor hailed him as the Orsonian beast, which is a poetic way of saying the beast from Italy, the beast from the Western land.
Yeah.
But he rather liked this designation, actually appropriated it for himself. So he wanted people to fear him. That's the message he was trying to send at Alexandria.
I also read into it that there's the implication that he may have sacrificed humans in divine honour.
What Cassius Dio was saying here is that the slaughter of these Alexandrians is like a human sacrifice. So Caracalla was sacrificing animals to the god Serapis when he's living in the temple there, and the fact that he's massacring the Alexandrians is like they're some kind of human sacrifice as well.
Was Rome okay with this sort of action? Was there any indication of what Rome thought of Caracalla doing this to Romans?
This was not something that the Roman Senate would have been on board with. Definitely, you know, he wrote to the Senate saying, it doesn't matter who I've killed, this is retribution for what they've done to me.
Mm.
And I think we see the horror in Cassius Dio. It's interesting that in Alexandria in the 3rd century, an interesting type of popular, almost resistance literature is circulating. This did circulate before the Severan period, but it became especially popular in the Severan period. Most of our examples survive from the 3rd century.
Mm.
And these are accounts of trials of Alexandrians before Roman emperors, but in which the Alexandrians get the upper hand. They're fictional. They're like little novels about what happens when an Alexandrian champion goes to Rome and they talk back to a Roman emperor, or sometimes they summon the god Serapis, do horrible things to the emperor in the case of one set in the early 2nd century AD. So there seems to be this popular type of resistance literature.
An underground resistance. He pushed it underground.
Well, yeah. People they weren't banned, and they've actually been found in some quite respectable households. But it seems that people like to read stories in which their fellow Alexandrians got the better of a Roman emperor. And this was a way of a vicarious pleasure. You know, they couldn't go up and stab Caracalla, but they could read stories about Roman emperors being cut down to size, at least metaphorically.
I have to wonder how Caracalla justified this to himself as well, especially essentially doing this to Alexander's people, if you want to look at it that way. They're Alexandrians. This is the place where his tomb is, and yet he's having this much vengeance against those people.
One of the things that crops up in the sources again and again is that he's not of sound mind. This is a man who murdered his brother in his mother's arms. I don't think he probably was of sound mind either. So I think that Caracalla probably wasn't too concerned with what people thought of him as long as they feared him.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review, as always, very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, Caracalla goes to war with Parthia. But until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.